Community Radio is KFAI FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, online and archived at kfai.org, the community's true voice.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Josh Weber, and on tonight's program, I talk with the author Gary Porter about his new children's novel, Little Rex, A Night at Sleepy Hollow Cemetery. Porter invites us into the adventures of a spirited little Boston Terrier who finds himself surrounded by history, mystery, and the supernatural on the Day of the Dead. What begins as a restless evening soon turns into a journey through Concord's most storied resting place, where the ghosts of Louisa May Alcott, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Henry David Thoreau, and Ralph Waldo Emerson come to life for one unforgettable night. Then, in the last part of the hour, I talk with Robert Saxton about his new young adult novel, Return of the Manitous, book two in the Tales from Gitche Gami trilogy. When a family friend disappears, B.J. Mackey, his sister Charlie, and their new neighbor Amy uncover clues that point not only to human wrongdoing, but to something older, darker, and far less human. Part thriller, part coming-of-age story, and part spiritual reckoning, Return of the Manitous blends indigenous lore with the stark beauty of the North Shore to ask, what do we owe the land that remembers us? All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio. Gary, whenever you are ready, you can begin your reading.
Thanks, Josh. Yeah, I thought I would read a little bit from the chapter where the ghosts and Rex are in the library. It's titled A Night at the Library, Dewey Decimals, and I thought that was appropriate given that the cover of the book shows little Rex in the library, scared out of his wits because of the town constable there. So from that chapter, here was the town constable, flashlight in hand, staring me down. Lucky I was never one to feel self-conscious. Still, I was petrified as to what my fate might be. My ghostly friends had slid between the walls, as all ghosts are capable of doing, obviously forgetting that wasn't an option for a living Boston Terrier. And they certainly couldn't come back in to rescue me now, not with the Concord cop staring me down. Well, I turned away from the man and made a beeline into the stacks. This might be my best chance in an escape. It quickly turned into a game of hide and seek, with my hiding losing ground to his seeking. In and out of the stacks I went, one step ahead of my seeker. Courtesy of the Dewey Decimals, I started in literature. The 800s, where me and my friends had gathered earlier. I turned the corner, down into the first of many aisles of biographies, those good old 921s. Next down the history aisles, ancient history popping up first. And I'm thinking, this is what I'm going to be, ancient history, if the man holding the flashlight that could double as a club ever caught up with me. I was running out of room, nearing the end of the 900s and nowhere else to turn. Out of breath, I turned back and figured I had no alternative other than to face the music. Well, in this case, face the Concord cop. What in the world are you doing in here, little fella? I remember reading that story a few years back about the cat left in the return bin outside a library and that cat becoming world famous. Dewey the Cat, I think that was his name. Is that what happened to you? Did someone who could no longer afford to feed you just dump you off in here? Well, I had no idea who Dewey the cat was, nor did I really care to know. Curiosity may have killed the cat, but I had no intention of joining my ghostly friends in the underworld. Nothing against those of the feline persuasion, but all I wanted to do was escape and rejoin my compatriots. Well, I'll tell you what, he said. Let's head over to the jail and get you set up for the night. Tomorrow morning, we can spread word around the village and see if we can't find your owner. Or if that's not possible, find someone who would like to adopt a cute fellow like you. I had never seen the inside of one, but the mere mention of the J word, that is a jail, sent chills up my spine.
That was Gary Porter reading from his heartwarming and imaginative new middle grade novel, Little Rex, A Night at Sleepy Hollow Cemetery. The book takes readers on an unforgettable journey through American history, literature, and the enduring bond between dogs and their humans, all told through the eyes of a little Boston Terrier with a big heart. Porter is a career educator and has taught at a number of universities, including Loyola University Chicago and University of St. Thomas. In addition to several textbooks, Gary has written magazine articles and three other books, Duffy, The Tale of a Terrier, Town Kid, Reflections of a Midwestern Boyhood, and Griff, My Life as Drake's Top Dog. Gary and his wife, Melissa, live in Hudson, Wisconsin, where they support conservation and animal welfare organizations. Gary, welcome to Right on Radio.
Thank you, Josh. It's a privilege and honor to be here.
When you first started writing Little Rex, what was the first scene or vision that came to you? The one that told you this wasn't just another chapter in Duffy's World, your previous novel, but Rex's own adventure?
Well, the first scene that really came to me was up in heaven, which are three chapters that take place there. And this story really is a prequel to Duffy, to Duffy's Tale of a Terrier. And so what came to me right away was the exchange that needed to take place up in heaven between Rex, the literary Boston Terrier, and his friend Duffy in heaven. So really, it was the very opening of the book that set the scene that I knew had to be the way that it had started out.
Rex is a proud, practical Boston Terrier and also protective of truth. Which single scene best encapsulates his personality to you, Gary?
I think Rex, he's a multifaceted character, no question. But I, thinking this over, what strikes me about his personality is at the Colonial Inn, when all of the four ghosts are gathered with him, and he's starved, and he has to find some nourishment. So Louis takes the lead. Louisa May Alcott takes the lead and says, let's go down to the Colonial Inn and see if we can't find Rex some food. He is starving and has been malnourished for a number of days. So yes, Rex is a very proud, caring, very observant terrier, as readers will find out, but he also got pretty testy. He's a hungry Boston Terrier. And so you see in this scene when they're going down to the Colonial Inn, which isn't an old historic inn in the heart of Concord, Massachusetts, that is where you see many different parts of his personality. Again, this observant, caring part, but also one that needs to find some nourishment.
Yeah, his Rex's first dog narration is brisk and humorous, yet he slips into curator mode when quoting authors. How did you decide when Rex would crack jokes versus when he'd step back and let history carry the moment?
You know, I think, Josh, that came very naturally, that because there's so much history surrounding the town of Concord, Massachusetts, which readers will find out and learn more about. But it's just something that came naturally that it made sense, as you said, for example, with the Old North Bridge, to let history kind of carry the moment, as you're saying. Another example of that is when the staunch abolitionist, old, as he's sometimes called, Captain John Brown, comes to town And so there are instances like that, which, yeah, Rex is cracking jokes and having fun with the ghosts, his four ghostly friends, but there's just natural times where it felt necessary to bring history in. And so that's what, there are other examples, but I think of the shot heard round the world at the Old North Bridge, and then when the ghost of John Brown appears, this abolitionist, that it was just history that would carry the moment, as you say.
Throughout the events of the book, you stage quotation cameos from Louisa May Alcott, Henry David Thoreau, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Ralph Waldo Emerson. What was your method for sourcing, trimming, and interweaving their real lines into the story?
Well, I can tell you that the method involved a lot of research. And that research, I'd say there are two facets to it. Part of it was just reading many stories, books, particularly biographies about these real people that lived in Concord, Mass in the mid-1800s. So it was that, a lot of reading, that kind of helped me tell their stories, but also a visit that my wife and I took a while back to Concord to do research and essentially walk the grounds, walk through Sleepy Hollow Cemetery, and walk around Walden Pond and around the delightful village, and kind of just absorb it all. So it was again, as you said, these guest appearances, the cameos that take place that really help tell the story. But how I wove those into the story was by, frankly, knowing enough about the characters and feeling like, not that I lived their lives, but I knew so much about them, about how Louisa May Alcott loved to run. She said at one time, I should have been, or I was, a deer in a previous life, the way that I loved to run. And then I learned early on in my research that Henry David Thoreau was a saunter. He loved to saunter, and there was a method to the way that he went about it. And as I talk about in the book, Rex, that he said, that was much more to my liking. He had these stubby little legs, and so for him, sauntering was his style. Let Louisa May go ahead and run ahead like a deer.
Your Alcott, the way you depict her in the book, is warm, kind, yet gently pedagogical. How did you find that balance so she reads like a living person on the page?
Well, again, I think to a large extent, I found the balance by learning and understanding more about each of the characters. And Louisa May, and she's known throughout the book, and she was well known during her lifetime as Louie, it was just understanding her as just like all the characters, all four of them, multifaceted in terms of their personalities. Yes, and we may talk about Hawthorne a little bit later. He was brooding. He was more aloof than any one of the other characters, including Ralph Waldo Emerson. So I think it was just learning as much as I could about their real lives, and then, you know, basically allowing them, in many cases, with these built-in quotes from the real authors, allowing them to tell their own stories.
Little Rex will delight, I think, and appeal to a lot of younger readers, but there are wings and layers for adults too. There's literary allusions, historical quips, and even philosophical nudges. How conscious were you of writing for two audiences at once?
Well, I think I was conscious of it because of my background. I think you mentioned at the outset in my introduction that I was a professor, a college professor. And so I've always been one that likes to teach and bring in teaching moments. And I did that with the Duffy Tale of a Terrier book, many teaching moments in that book. That book, Josh, wasn't specifically written for kids. My wife always likes to say it's for ages 8 to 80. Mm-hmm. But I found in that book, as well as in this, I think because of my background, it's always been natural, the way that I write. It is to engage the audience, whoever that audience might be, whether it's college students, or in the case of Duffy, tail of a terrier. That's had a real appeal to probably third, fourth, and fifth graders, or whether it's for adults. I feel like, again, whenever you're writing, you find ways to engage the audience. So yes, I think the Rex, Little Rex book will have appeal to not only kids, to engage them and to have a love of history and literature, but also to appeal to adults who want to know more about our history, literary and historical, of this country.
You just mentioned before that Thoreau saunters, but he also plays a flute and he coughs. He's very human. Can you walk us through your choice to include his fragility so kids meet the person as much as the idealized poet and philosopher and naturalist we mostly associate with Thoreau?
Sure, you're exactly right. So many people, Josh, have the impression of Henry David Thoreau as a recluse, as a hermit. He went out to Walden and just disappeared. Well, nothing could be more further from the truth. Yes, he was there for 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days, officially, but he went into town. He went into town on a regular basis. He came in on weekends and ate with his family and had dinner. So again, like all these characters, there was a lot more to his personality. So how did I go about telling more about his character, and as you say, his fragility? It was through different facets of things that he did. He did regularly play a flute, and there's instances that are told when you read about his life and biographies that he did that for the kids around the town of Concord. He regularly played the flute for them. So I thought, well, this is a natural. One of the ways that he will basically become a good buddy and a pal of Little Rex's is by playing the flute. And he does that a few different times, at least once or twice when Rex finds himself in trouble. So, and then there is that. I decided to bring in a couple of different times some foreshadowing that Henry David Thoreau, some of your audience may know, died relatively young, much younger than any one of the other three characters. And it was incessant coughing that he had throughout his life, and eventually said died at a relatively young age. So I brought in a couple of different instances of that coughing to show that, yes, he was a living human being that coughed, played the flute, sauntered, and all those different aspects of his life I tried to call attention to.
Emerson's Trust Thyself meets a stray, streetwise independence in the character Rex. How did you keep self-reliance from drifting into rugged isolation, especially as community? By community, I mean like the collective of the four authors literally materializes to guide Rex in the novel.
Yeah, that's really a good question that I wanted to talk a bit about. That these transcendentalists, as they were known, and they were the leaders, particularly Emerson, of that group in the mid-1800s. The idea, as Emerson said in his one of his most famous essays, Self-Reliance, they were individualists, and to, as you said, trust thyself. But then they meet this streetwise little character, this Boston Terrier named Rex. And so there's this rugged isolation. Rex learned to be self-reliant, as he talks about. He's had to live on the streets of Boston almost his entire life after he was given up by his master. And by the way, his master is interwoven throughout the story as well and has an important part in it, as he is a book editor, as readers will find out, or that they may know from reading Duffy's tale. But Rex is a very independent sort. Those characters are, because of their self-reliance, and so to speak. But at the same time, they learned how to get along and form community. In fact, at least one of them, Hawthorne, lived at one time for a short while as part of a communal living experiment. Those were popular at that time in the mid-1800s. But they find throughout the book, they find ways that they need to work together, and particularly to help Rex with food early on when they said they end up at Colonial Inn and need to find him food. And I won't give too much away, but there is a scene involving a witch from the Salem witch trials. And that's going to take some cooperation, that they can't just all go on and be on their own. And then, of course, out at Walden Pond, something happens out there that requires that they work as a team.
There's chapters like A Night at the Library and The Old North Bridge that carry gentle lessons about history, ethics, and belief. Was your goal to write a story that teachers and parents could share in classrooms, or did that educational layer appear naturally as the story evolved?
No, I think it was, I would say, pretty much a conscious decision on my part from the outset. As we talked about a little earlier in this interview, from Duffy's Tale of a Terrier, there's a lot of pedagogy there. And again, I think that comes through because of my career as a teacher, being in the classroom all those years. So it certainly was a goal, I would say, from the beginning of it, to this to be something that could be shared by teachers in the classroom and or parents working with their kids in the home. It was a goal that I wanted. This is, of course, historical fiction. I should make that clear, too. And so I wanted it to be a fictional. If you're going to have a talking dog, Josh, then yeah, most people would say that's fiction, right? And of course, I talk at some point about kids, especially needing to decide what they believe and what they don't believe is really true. So it is historical fiction, but I think that was the genre I wanted to use to try and enthuse young readers, especially about some of our history, going back to the Revolutionary War and the shot heard around the world, as well as some lessons that, because of the Civil War. Listeners may not know that Louisa May Alcott had a short stint as a nurse during the Civil War in Georgetown in the Washington, D.C. area. So it was just something that I had a goal from the beginning to try and particularly get young kids enthusiastic about the history of our country, and particularly our literary history, with these characters being at the very forefront of that.
So I've asked about Emerson, I've asked about Alcott, I've asked about Thoreau. I need to ask about Hawthorne. Hawthorne arrives.
Sure.
He's handsome, he's brooding, and initially aloof, then opens with compact maxims about action and autumn sunlight. What was your compass for calibrating his arc from cool to companionable?
Well, the way that I went about that, you referred to, I think there's quotes throughout the book, as I've said, that are the exact quotes from all four of these famous Concord authors, who are, of course, are buried in Sleepy Hollow on Author's Ridge. So some of the ways that I brought other kind of sides of Hawthorne, or other than this brooding, aloof person, which I make him out to be at certain times, because he really is. When he comes up from the grave to join Henry and Louisa May, and before Ralph Waldo appears, I paint that him in that light, that he is somewhat brooding and aloof. But yes, through some of his quotes you referred to, the autumn sunlight and so forth, there was that side of him that was more than someone that was just aloof to everyone. And then another way that I brought that out, tried to bring it out, is with the one chapter where him and Rex are off on their own. He has a little bit of a issue with the very staunch abolitionist. Not that he is himself in any way in favor of slavery, but readers will find in a certain part of the book that he doesn't quite share the kind of drastic methods of, say, a John Brown, and the other authors they're fine by that. But anyway, there's a part where Hawthorne and Little Rex end up going off on their own and have this episode with one of the Salem witches. We'll leave it at that, but it's in that episode that I decided this is a way to bring in another side of Nathaniel Hawthorne, one that has kind of a soft spot and a human side to him.
From the Colonial Inn's rumored room 24 to the old man's window view down to the bridge, Concord feels like a character unto itself. What's your favorite tangible detail you found on site in Concord that made it onto the page?
Yeah, that's a great question. I love this question because, as I said earlier, my wife and I went out and spent a few days totally absorbed in the town itself, the village. And by the way, some of your listeners and readers of the book may not realize Concord, Mass, back in the mid-1800s, was a village, a classic New England village of about 2,000 inhabitants. And that's what, just as an aside here for a minute, that's what so excited me the more and more I started to not only read about the town, but also decide I wanted to write about it, was to think that a town of 2,000 would produce these world-class writers who are, they're part of our literary history. So anyway, on that tour of the village, starting one morning out at Sleepy Hollow Cemetery and continuing on through 2-3 days worth of exploring every aspect of the town, including out to Walden Pond itself. Orchard House is where Louisa May Alcott wrote Little Women. And of course, I should mention, yes, Rex was in the Duffy book, and that was Rex's name in the book. The title Little Rex comes from Louisa May giving a nod to Rex. And by the way, Rex in Latin is king or ruler, which he was very proud to have found that out from courtesy of Louisa May Alcott. But anyway, she decided it ought to be Little Rex as a nod to her famous book, Little Women. Well, one of the things we found out and with a tour from Jan Turnquist, who is the executive director of Orchard House, and she took us to the room. There is a room on the upper level of Orchard House, which is now a living history museum. And you see the desk over there in the corner of that room where Louisa May Alcott wrote Little Women. So if you ask me the question, what is the one most tangible detail from our visit on site to Concord that made it onto the page, it's that room and that writing desk in the Orchard House. No question.
And I believe my last question for you, Gary, your note to young readers invites them to decide what to believe and what not to believe. With ghosts and a talking dog on the Day of the Dead, what do you hope kids conclude about truth in historical fiction after walking with Rex and Concord's literary luminaries you present in Little Rex?
Well, yes, I say it kind of jokingly about you decide what to believe and what not to believe, because is there such a thing as a talking dog? Most of us, I think, would agree that dogs don't talk. But I think what I want young readers to take away from this is that you need to do your own research as a reader. And I'm hoping, too, that this book will help instill in kids not just a love for reading, but also a love of writing, that it will get them enthusiastic about doing research and doing their own writing. And so I'm hopeful that the message they take away from this is to use your imagination. And yes, this book was meant to be historical fiction, so it's fictionalized, but do your own research. And if you're interested in this type of work to understand what's real and what you can use your imagination to do. So that's the plan with the book, to install in readers love of history as I have. And who knows, down the road, as I explore future writing opportunities, we have dogs of our own that still need to tell their own stories. I'm intrigued by cemeteries, by the way, so whether or not in another story or in a book, there may be some involvement in a cemetery. It wouldn't surprise myself if that's what happens.
So in the closing pages, Duffy and Rex share a moment that feels like an ending and an invitation. Do you see more stories coming from this world? Could there be more knights in other historic places, other cemeteries? That's your plan right now?
Yeah, I think so. I won't give too much more away, but as I said just a minute ago, our dogs, Daisy, Polly, who've since passed on, and now Moxie, still have their own stories that could be told. And I love writing stories about dogs. Two of my three previous ones had dogs in them, and now this one. So yeah, I could see whether choosing a dog as a device, as a way to tell a story, maybe or maybe not. But as I said, I wouldn't be too surprised if a cemetery was involved down the road in another story. And I do like historical fiction, and I hope that comes through as people read the book, is that I think there's so much that can be gained for us as readers by historical fiction, that blend of what's real in terms of history with what you can embellish it with.
And that's our time with Gary Porter, author of Little Rex, A Night at Sleepy Hollow Cemetery, a story where history, literature, and a little dog's courage come together in one unforgettable night on the Day of the Dead. You can find Little Rex wherever books are sold. Gary, thanks for joining us on Right on Radio.
Thanks so much, Josh, for having me.
And now this.
Hey there, music heads. DJ Shrimp Chips here, letting you know that MSG Radio is moving from Thursday mornings to Tuesdays 6 to 7 p.m. I'll still be serving up the same tasty umami flavor, just at a new and improved time. For those new to the show, MSG explores the intersection of Asian diaspora, experimental music, and electronica. From there, sky's the limit. So join me, DJ Shrimp Chips, on Tuesdays 6 to 7 p.m. for MSG Radio, the sound of umami.
Support for KFAI comes from the 13th annual Festival de las Calaveras, Saturday, November 1st at the Hook and Ladder Theater in the 30th Avenue block of Minnehaha Avenue. It'll be a Latin Day of the Dead celebration with music, food, and activities for the whole family. Scheduled to appear are Nortec, Bastech and Fusible, Tijuana No, Sergeant Papers, Making Movies, Lady Midnight, Rudos Lucha Libre, Westside St. Paul Lowriders, Danza Mexica, Food Trucks, Face Painting, and more. More information on the 13th annual Festival de las Calaveras is available at festivalcalaveras.com.
Why did they come? Asked BJ, feeling a flood of emotions rise. What do they want?
I don't know, admitted Russ. It's been a long time since they... It's never good. Wendigos take. They consume. They destroy.
Just like the white man, quipped Amy. BJ felt stung by her words. Russ considered Amy for a moment.
Are you sure you want to disparage an entire race?
Why shouldn't I? She said.
Lumping human beings together and treating them poorly because of the way they look is how we got here. Don't be tempted to play that game. Listen, as far as America goes, you're partially right. From Columbus's first rape of an Indian girl to centuries of genocide, slavery, Jim Crow, the Ku Klux Klan, boarding schools, racism, and even voter suppression, the history of this country is the history of white supremacy. The people who still benefit from that system have plenty to learn and a lot of work to do. Most Americans have not had the courage to face those demons. It must be done.
Amy began to respond, but Russ held out a hand and continued.
Yes, there are white folk who are happy with that history and who would gladly repeat it, but there are an awful lot who are ashamed of it and are doing their best to fix the system they've inherited. Don't put them all in the same net. I've been around for a very long time, and I can tell you that natives have more friends and allies right now than they've ever had. And it's getting better. Besides, Amy, white folk have no monopoly on evil deeds. At this very moment, there are people of every color and creed across the earth doing horrible things to one another, even on Indian reservations.
That was Robert Saxton reading from his latest novel, Return of the Manitos, a story that fuses myth, ecology, and moral reckoning into something both ancient and urgently modern. Set against the raw landscapes of the North Country, forests, lakes, and the ghostly echoes of ancestral ground, Saxton's novel follows characters who find themselves drawn into the pulse of a living world that refuses to be forgotten. Through their journeys, Return of the Manitos asks powerful questions. What happens when a people lose their relationship with the spirit of a place? Can broken worlds, human and natural, be reconciled? And what does redemption look like when it comes not from civilization, but from the land itself? Saxton is a multilingual world traveler, nature enthusiast, husband, father, EMT first responder, and educator. He lives in North Woods of Minnesota with 10 chickens, 2 dogs, 1 wife, and 3 kick-ass children. Robert, welcome to Right on Radio.
Good morning, Josh. Thanks for having me on.
So Robert, what first inspired Return of the Manitos? Did it begin as a spiritual exploration, an ecological warning, or something else entirely?
So Return of the Manitos is a continuation of book one in what is turning out to be the trilogy that I'm calling Tales from Gichigami. Book one is Shades of a Warrior. That story began as a bedtime tale that I spun for my kids in the evenings to encourage them to spend time outdoors and in the woods. And the reason I was thinking about that in terms of their growth was my own love of nature and the outdoors and the wilderness, and my experience with Tom Brown Jr. and the Tracker School, which I discovered a year before our first child was born. Tom Brown was a tracker and a survivalist, a master tracker and a survivalist, who was mentored by an Apache, an old Apache man named Stalking Wolf. And Tom learned the skills and honed his spiritual relationship with the earth in 10 years of mentoring by Stalking Wolf. And then he created his school and he taught and trained and mentored thousands upon thousands of people, including me. So my eyes were opened very wide to that type of relationship with the natural world. It was fun, it was challenging, it was fulfilling. And so that was really a fork in my road, Josh, in terms of how I approached living life and what I thought my role here on earth and my duties to my family and community were. So that informed how I raised my kids. And what this story turned into was a larger teaching of how to develop connections with the natural world and the earth, and B, how to think about what is important and who is important in our lives. So that's awfully heady and that's awfully serious stuff, right? So I punctuated it with a lot of farts and penis jokes and all that stuff. So that's where the story began. So I placed my character, who I designed after our eldest child, Tommy. I placed him in a place that was of supreme importance to me, which is on the North Shore of Minnesota, in and around Grand Marais. My ancestral cabin is just across the border from there, so the biome is the same thing. Granite outcroppings, rugged coniferous forests, boreal wilderness. And as soon as I placed him there, I thought, okay, he has to have a way to learn these things. And I thought, okay, who's going to teach him? And then I thought, well, the Ojibwe are there. The Ojibwe have been there for a long time. And I thought they would be great mentors. And so before I knew it, my story was my protagonist learning these connections with the earth and how to sit still and pay attention and be quiet and do all these things. And his teachers were Ojibwe. Now, I have a lot of connections and relationships with Native peoples in and around Bemidji. I've been here for 21 years and been to ceremony and first kill ceremonies and have a lot of Native friends. And I've done a lot of reading, which we can talk about. So I've got my toes in the Anishinaabe world a fair amount. So I thought, okay, I can have his mentors be Native. I can have them be Ojibwe. If I do that, it's incumbent upon me to do a little bit of Ojibwe 101. I did a little bit. I didn't do a lot. So I didn't dive into serious ceremonial stuff or cultural heritage, stuff like that. But I did get into a little bit about the culture and some of their habits and some of the history and some of the true history. And by book two, Return of the Manitous, that true history turned into some of the tough stuff, like the Allotment Act and like missing and murdered indigenous relatives and historical trauma and spiritual trauma and resilience and themes that ended up folding a story because the Ojibwe were a strong part of it.
Yeah, your book doesn't shy away from showing how colonial disruption led to both spiritual and environmental degradation. How did you balance historical critique with narrative empathy?
True history, especially right now, is really important. I am a European history major, and I've lived in Europe for a number of years. I've lived in Mexico. And the more you study history, the more nuance you see. The harder it is to have very simple, very clean, black and white descriptions and conclusions about the way the world unfolds. It's messy. Our history is messy. And you end up seeing the perspectives of lots of people that you would rather be angry at. So that's one thing that happens when you really, really look at history with an open mind. So as I got into this story, the story is obviously very pro-environment, very pro-native, very pro-diversity, pro-language, multilingual, but I've got monolingual settler type white folk in the story. I can't make them all horrible people because they're not all horrible people and they don't all mean to be horrible or realize when they're doing harmful things. I volunteer with people like that as a first responder. I really like them. Like, there are decent people all around, and I know that we can tap into that decency if we are smart and careful about it. So I needed to give a little bit of their perspective and humanize them too, because they deserve it.
How did you conduct research and approach the portrayal of the Manitous to ensure authenticity and respect for living indigenous traditions?
So I've done a ton of reading. I've got on my bookshelf, which you can't see here, dozens of books authored by natives. Some of them are Basil Johnston, Jim Northrup, Ann Dunn, Eddie Benton Benet, William Warren, Carl Galboy, Anton Troyer. Just started reading a couple from Stacy Druyard. A ton of reading, and there are a lot of tales the ancestors told, and they get a lot into Manitous and the spirits. And Manitous, for new listeners, a Manitou is a spirit being. That's what it means. There can be little ones, big ones, nice ones, mean ones, scary ones. So that's the spirit world, right? Over decades of reading about them, I've absorbed a lot of that information and a lot of how they thought about their connection to that spirit world. Also here in Bemidji, as I mentioned earlier, participating in a lot of ceremony and listening to a lot of stories in English and some in Ojibwe. I'm not fluent in Ojibwe. I've taken a few classes and I can say some sentences and know a lot of individual words and things like that. Having been around all of that, I've listened very carefully and I've read very carefully and I've observed. And so I got a fairly decent grasp of the Anishinaabe relationship with the spirit world. I would not claim to be an expert ever, but I've got a little bit, enough of a grasp so that I can give readers a taste of it and maybe make them, inspire them to dig into it more.
The Manitous in your novel, they're not distant deities. They act, intervene, remember. How do you understand the function of myth today, especially in an era of environmental crisis?
A lot of Native peoples around the world, and probably maybe all our ancestors, ran on the assumption that the spirit world and spirits were interacting with us constantly. And whether you think of a spirit being as a metaphor or a real life character, it doesn't really matter. I think the stories and myths are great teaching tools. For example, the hunter that did not give thanks to the deer's spirit, so that the spirit told the other deer to stay away from him because he was not worthy of harvesting them. The stories of the Manitous and the spirits are important for teaching. They're important for inspiring. Tom believed that a lot of our physical disagreements and battles were being mirrored in the spirit world. The same thing was happening in the spirit world. So I like playing in that gray area of spirit and flesh, where there's a little bit of back and forth. And that always makes an interesting story, I think. I think it's a neat way to think about our world also.
At its heart, your novel, Robert, feels like a story about reconnection to land, ancestry, and the unseen world. How do you see reconciliation between human and spirit worlds playing out through your characters' arcs?
So Tom always taught us something that I think is extremely important, and I have put this in the book almost verbatim, and that is that a deep connection with the earth is our birthright. It's everybody's birthright. It's not an Indian thing. It's not a white thing. It's not an Asian or African thing. It is a human birthright to have a strong spiritual connection with the earth, a strong and revitalized culture and language and joyful life while we're here. That's one way I've looked at it. I think the closer we are to silence, the closer we are to spirit and the spirit world. That's when the magic happens. So reconciling the human and spirit worlds through the character arcs, there's always been a tension with the human life and what we think of as the spirit life. So we tell a lot of stories in and around this. I think the human life tends towards noise and consumption. And the more noise and the more consumption we experience, I think the further away we are from silence, and maybe the further away we are from peace and spirit. So those are some of the tensions that I think about a lot and that I have attempted to write about.
Your novel does suggest that true understanding comes from silence and attentiveness rather than speech. How do you interpret the role of silence? Do you see it as a form of resistance, reverence, surrender, an act of being humble? What do you think?
So the crux of the story revolves around what Tom Brown and his first student, John Young, call the sit spot. Sometimes we call it the sacred spot or the sacred area. This entire story swirls around my protagonist, BJ, learning how to go sit in the woods a little bit every day, quietly, as best he can. This is not easy for him. It's not easy for any of us, especially in our modern lives, to be quiet, to sit still. We have noises in our head all the time, all the time, all the time. But I think anybody who has experienced some type of sacred silence will tell you that that's when magic things happen. When you sit still long enough and you're not thinking about the grocery bill or political stuff or whatever, which is extremely hard right now. But when you do that, and if you're able to do that, that's when little discoveries are made. That's where creative things pop into your mind. That's when you notice little things in the background. I went out before we visited Josh, and I stood near the area where my sort of sacred area is, and I faced the marsh. I've got a wetland, thanks to a new beaver family that built a lodge and a dam and raised the water about a foot or two. So now we've got geese and ducks and swans and otters and all sorts of interesting
critters out there. So I was looking at them, and a great blue heron flew over my right side. The swans flap, honked, and banged their wings against the water as they flew off to the south, and a couple of ducks were quacking at each other, and I stood there, and I was quiet. And then, when I got quiet enough, my brain noticed the chipmunk alarming 100 yards to my north. And I thought about that for a second, and I thought, oh, I'm upwind of that chipmunk, and probably of a deer that just jumped out of his bed because he smelled me and scared the bejeebers out of that chipmunk who was pissed off and alarming at him. So I quieted down just enough so that I really understood what was going on around me, right? And the part about silence that's important, one of the main things that I think is important, is awareness. So being silent allows us to be aware of the things that are happening around us for purposes of, let's call it threat assessment, for dangers, risks, threat assessment, but also aware of the people around us and their needs and feelings, right? So when we're quiet, we are more in tune with the messages that we get from our friends and family and the animals and the birds and all that stuff, right? The more we're in tune to people's needs, and the more we can say, you know, call up and say, how are you? The more we can check in on our loved ones, the better we are at that kind of stuff. Silence helps that along.
Your honk honk made me think of asking you this question. Your prose frequently draws on tactile and auditory imagery, wind through birch leaves, the crack of ice, animal cries. How do you approach sensory writing to immerse the reader?
Big loud farts, uncircumcised penises, blah, blah, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do I approach it? So it's in writing, you want to set the stage. In every scene, you want to set the stage, right? So good writers give the reader a stage that they can imagine. They can imagine a sound, maybe a smell. And that helps them get into that scene. Now, Stephen King opined in his book on writing that you don't want to do too much. He likes to give people two or three descriptors of a person or a place and let the reader fill in the rest. And the reason for that is, he's like, because your story is the focus. That's the goal. What's the story? Get back to the story. Don't get bogged down with descriptors. Now, if you start reading J.R.R. Tolkien, he will describe, you know, one frickin' tree for like two pages, you know. I mean, and some of us really love that. And that can be really fun. It's fun getting into the mind of somebody who sees details, like a lot of details. That's fun for me. Our daughter is like that. Charlotte, ever since she was tiny, can pick something up and just look at it. And I know she is absorbing so many details about the things she's looking at. Colors, shades, texture, bumps, things like that. And it turns out, lo and behold, that she's a very good painter and drawer because she sees those things, right? So anyway, there's a balance between one or two quick descriptors of a place and Tolkien description of a tree. I like to give a little bit more than Stephen King because I also am sort of surreptitiously tweaking the reader to realize that there's stuff going on there that you might not have been noticing or that you might not have been paying attention to. And for me, if that reader goes out the next day and sticks their nose on the side of a tree and smells what that bark looks like, I mean, that's awesome. Then I've done something really neat.
So the Return of Manitou's depiction of the northern forests and lakes feel alive and sometimes even conscious. How did you craft the setting so that it functions not just as a backdrop, but also as an active presence?
Okay, so active presence, right? So let's talk about language. The Ojibwe language, you may know this, some of our listeners may know this, is a verb-based language. In other words, they don't have inactive and inanimate, they don't have many inanimate nouns.
as we think of them, right? So they have objects that are being something. It's being a tree. It's being a rock. It's being, right? And so isn't that an interesting way to look at the world? Like you're walking through the forest and there's a lot of quote unquote inanimate objects, but they're being something, right? So they're active. So if you start thinking that way and you're taking a walk anywhere and looking at the natural world around you, or if you're writing a scene, it's fun to describe the whole thing as a giant web of living things that are fulfilling a purpose. So they're living their purpose. That's another native phrase. They're living their purpose. They're following their instructions is another old term. So that's one of the ways that I think about it. And it's, I think, a fun way to look at the world.
And my last question for you, Robert, without revealing any spoilers, the conclusion to this novel feels both luminous and unresolved. What emotional or philosophical state did you hope to leave readers in after the final page?
Well, so Return of the Manitous has that title for a reason. So there is the return of the trickster character who plays a very important role. And I should say about him that the story takes place in winter, okay? And so the Ojibwe and a lot of northern tribes reserved most of their stories, a lot of their stories, for winter time, which, if you think about it, has a very practical purpose. Because if it's hard for us to be cooped up in the winter these days with all the things we have going on inside a building, can you imagine raising a pack of kids in like one lodge, you know, in the winter? I mean, so you hold on to stories that are going to take hours and hours and days, right? So winter and the spirits are intricately connected, right? So I'll also say that that trickster character sort of came knocking on the door early on in the last book, and I visited with an elder native friend. We were hanging out. And I talked to him about it, and he said, well, if he comes knocking, you better let him in. And so I let him in. And much like a lot of other writers have always said, they're surprised at what their characters end up doing. That's a real thing. Like, that is a real phenomenon. And this character really does what the hell he wants. And so I kind of, every now and then I sat back and I'm like, you're kidding me, really? We're going to go there? And I was like, yep, we're going there. But it gives me tingles just thinking about it, because you have created a spirit. You've almost created a spirit. Now, this spirit was pre-existing. I just opened the door, let him come in, and he kind of wreaked havoc, you know, here and there. And I was like, okay, how are we going to do this? So what do I want to leave people with on the last page? Mostly confusion and hilarity, because he plays a good one on the entire town, and it's the reveal doesn't happen until the last page of the entire story. And so that was plenty of fun. And like I said, I only get partial credit for being the co-pilot on that whole prank.
You've been listening to Write on Radio, and our guest has been Robert Saxton, author of Return of the Manitous, a deeply human novel that reminds us that stories don't just describe the world. Sometimes they help the world remember itself. Robert, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Josh. I enjoyed it.
And now this. You have been listening to Write on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Josh Weber, and I would like to thank Gary Porter, Robert Saxton, and all of our listeners. Without your support, KFAI would not be possible. Now stay tuned to Bonjour, Minnesota.